Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward online and on as seen on PBS, and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, and sitting in today for Diane Rehm. During a primetime address to the nation last night, President Barack Obama tried to regain control of the debate over health care.
Now is the season for action. Now is when we must bring the best ideas of both parties together and show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on health care.
You heard applause there. There were some other things to be heard during that speech as well last night. But he said the time for bickering was over and the time for games has passed. True? Joining me in the studio to discuss the president's address and what's next in the debate over health care, political reporter Carrie Budoff-Brown, Joseph Antos with the American Enterprise Institute, and Judy Fader with the Center for American Progress. Also on the phone, Norman Ornstein, who's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Norm, let's start with you on the phone. Did the president succeed last night in reframing the debate, which, as we know, has taken on a decidedly negative tone in recent weeks?
I'm not sure he took away from the negative tone in the end, even though to some degree he tried, although, Frank, it was a kind of artful mix of here are some concessions to you, let's all reason together, let's move past this partisan divide, with some pretty artful jabs at his adversaries as well. But I do think he made a serious inroad into changing the debate here, in part by shifting the focus, as he did in the first third of his speech, to the insured, and not just telling them that you'll be able to keep what you have, but boy, this is going to be so much better for you. And that may alleviate many of the concerns and the levels of unease that independent voters and even some Democrats have had about taking this giant step, and that will be big for him.
Carrie, you've been writing about health care for Politico, which is both politics and policy. Mm-hmm. What's your headline this morning?
The headline this morning is actually Joe Wilson, unfortunately, probably for people who wanted to learn a little bit about health care reform and what he said last night. I mean, that did lead our story, but that was it was a moment that spoke to kind of the politics and the tone and the atmospherics of what he's facing.
Well, let me stop you, and we'll just give a listen to what that moment sounded like last night when the president was speaking and Joe Wilson was listening, and then...
Now, this is the plan I'm proposing. It's a plan that incorporates ideas from many of the people in this room tonight, Democrats and Republicans. And I will continue to seek common ground in the weeks ahead. If you... There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal.
Carrie, I thought I was in London listening to the British Parliament for a minute there.
Yeah, I also heard an analogy to some other countries where it's a little more boisterous in these environments. It was a very unusual thing to happen in Congress to a sitting president. And, you know, within minutes of the speech ending, he was called on by his colleagues, Republicans, to apologize, and he did. But Democrats are still going to be talking about that today, using that as an emblem of what the president's facing and the juxtaposition between, you know, a poised president and a member speaking out like that.
Judy Fader, it was a remarkable moment and a moment, but does it tell us anything more than just that there was some a lapse of decorum, perhaps?
Oh, I think it's consistent with the bitterness and the extreme behavior that we saw in the town hall meetings, of a strength of vitriol opposed to government, to Obama, to health reform, to just kind of stopping Obama on ideological grounds that has poisoned the debate. And I think that Obama was trying very hard to put it back on the terms that American people really care about.
So, Joe Antos, bring us back to where we started, which is whether in this speech last night, with the atmospherics and the particulars and the politics, the president changed the dynamic at all and, to his point, made the passage of health care reform any more likely.
Well, I think he was really talking to the Senate more than anybody else.
Really? You don't think he was trying to talk right over their heads and to the American people?
Well, he was addressing them as well. But his first political problem is getting something out of the Senate. If you don't do that, you certainly don't have health reform. Any disagreements that there might be among Democrats can be settled one way or another once there are bills out of the Senate and out of the House. Until then, we're still in a game of tactics and strategy politically. So I'm not saying that he wasn't trying to send a message and themes to the American people, but the underlying real story here, I think, is the political story. How are you going to get the Senate to move?
Norm Ornstein, agree with that?
I do agree with that. But I also think that what Joe Wilson did, the Republican congressman from South Carolina who shouted out, "You lie," was to make the task of Obama in the House much easier. In effect, he's had difficulty pulling his liberal core in the House, which has insisted on a full-fledged public plan, to join with him if we back off a little bit from that. When you get that kind of divisive move, as Wilson did, it unites Democrats. It makes them think that the last thing that they could afford to do is to give their enemies a victory by letting this whole thing go down. So that was a move that was equivalent to me of a comment that a Republican Senator Jim DeMint had made, that this issue would be Obama's Waterloo. It just makes it easier to unite Democrats in the House, but there's still the question of where you can get the votes in the Senate.
Kerry, the Senate?
Yeah, no, I agree with Joe that his speech, while it was meant to speak to average Americans, and he clearly did, there were lots of lines in there that were directly targeted at certain lawmakers, making the concession to John McCain and saying that he's taking one of his ideas, talking to Chuck Grassley and Orrin Hatch and reminding them of a time when they used to work with Ted Kennedy and they supported certain reforms, and talking to the lawmakers, scolding Republicans, the leadership, for passing tax cuts, funding the Iraq War, without paying for it. So there were a lot of direct messages at those members in that chamber, some of which rubbed some of them the wrong way, and we're going to hear more about that today.
We're going to hear a lot more about all of this. One of the things we'd like to do today is invite our callers, our listeners, to join the conversation a little earlier than is often the case here, because this is such a public issue and something that affects all people. So if you'd like to join the discussion, or if you have a panel, a question for our panel, our number is 1-800-433-8850. That's 1-800-433-8850, or you can email us your question or comment at drshow@wamu.org, and we'll move to that fairly quickly. Joe, there was an interesting poll that CNN did on the heels of the discussion, and what they found is interesting, though I'm not sure it's definitive. Polls seldom are, but they found that 2 out of 3 Americans who watched the president's speech now favor his health care reform plan. They found that 1 out of 7 said they changed their minds as a result of it. 67% questioned in this survey now say they support the health care reform proposals as outlined by the president. 29% oppose. Meaningful?
To some extent. I think what it says is that summer's over. most people haven't been paying that much attention. Of course, we had the August follies, but that wasn't necessarily fact-based discussion. This was the first time when people were trapped at home because their kids are going to school, so they're watching television. They're hearing for the first time, and I think words that they can understand, what at least some of the issues are. And so I'm not surprised that he got a bump. I'm a little surprised that he got such a big bump. Let's check tomorrow.
Judy, what he said was, among other, he said many things, but he tried to climb into the particulars. He said his plan would provide more security and stability to those who have health insurance, that it would provide insurance to those who don't, and he insisted it'll slow the growth of health care costs for families, businesses, and government.
He absolutely did, and I think that, as Norm said at the outset, he really made very clear that Americans who have insurance need these insurance reforms and a system that works, as well as affordable health care, to hold on to what we've got. So I thought he was enormously effective in both dispelling the myths, despite Joe Wilson, or perhaps with Joe Wilson's help, and I thought that he was really extremely effective, and I actually disagree a little bit with Joe on on the level of interest in what this tells. I think that Americans are very concerned about health care and have been watching this debate and got much too confused and scared by the awful stuff in August. And there, I think having the president take charge, as he did last night, is exactly what the American people are looking for to solve problems they care about.
Carrie, what did he say? And then Norm Ornstein, jump in on this, because I'd be interested in your thoughts, but fairly briefly, if you could. What did he say? What did he hold out in this proposed plan that would somehow satisfy both conservatives and progressive Democrats?
Well, he talked about it being deficit neutral. He talked about reining in costs. The pre-existing conditions, the insurance market reforms, those are all things that have gotten pretty broad bipartisan support. So that is what will please both sides. But there's so much on either side that both sides want that, even if he put out medical malpractice reforms as a possibility, I talked to a senior GOP aide yesterday who said it doesn't really matter. It's so way outweighed by a public insurance option.
Norm Ornstein?
I think getting a sizable number of Republicans to support any plan now, when the whole center of gravity on the right is deny Barack Obama any kind of victory, it's a very tough sell almost no matter what you do. And the step on tort reform, medical malpractice reform, kind of demonstration projects in the states wouldn't move it in that direction anyhow. But I think that one of the great difficulties the president's going to have is this pledge of fiscal neutrality off into the distant future.
Tough task.
I wish that the cameras had switched to Peter Orszag, who I suspect was showing some signs of discomfort with that particular pledge.
More on that discomfort and how the books will be balanced. Your calls and questions for our panel on Barack Obama's health care plan when the Diane Rehm Show continues. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about President Barack Obama's speech. In case you missed it last night, there was this moment.
And while there remain some significant details to be ironed out, I believe a broad consensus exists for the aspects of the plan I just outlined. Consumer protections for those with insurance, an exchange that allows individuals and small businesses to purchase affordable coverage, and a requirement that people who can afford insurance get insurance.
Judy Fetter, you're at the Center for American Progress, a professor of public policy at Georgetown University. You traffic in details.
I do indeed.
And we heard laughter on the floor. We saw laughter on the floor when the president said there are details to be worked out. Norm Ornstein a few moments ago was talking about the fiscal details, how we pay for it, that needs to be worked out.
How we pay for it is a big one. And I would say that throughout this debate, while much else has been discussed, that the money is always an issue here because we've got to have the money to provide subsidies for affordable coverage. At the same time, we've got to pull money out of the system by getting rid of the inefficiencies and making it more affordable. And I think what the president added last night, in addition to saying that he's not going to sign a bill that adds a dime time to the deficit is that he added the concept of a fail-safe, a guarantee that that the plan, the health reform, will live within the expenditures that are put forward and the resources put forward. And at the Center for American Progress with David Cutler, he and I have been advocating that kind of fail-safe for some time. And I would just say briefly what it is, if you what the
Very
way I understand
quickly,
it.
If you would.
Sure. The problem, when you mentioned Peter Orszag, the problem is that
the
we
budget
know,
director.
The budget director, when we know that there is tremendous potential for greater efficiencies in the system through payment and delivery reform. But the Congressional Budget Office is not scoring those savings because of uncertainties about moving forward. What a fail-safe does, as we've advocated, is monitor the spending and say that if those savings are not achieved, and we have reasons to believe they will be achieved, then other savings specified in legislation identified by experts will kick in so that the savings are guaranteed.
Meaning if you don't save what you say you're going to save, you cut the budget someplace else.
That's right.
All right. And so where would that be? Let's lay it right out. What kind? So you go over by $10 billion. What gets cut?
Well, you've got what we wanted is you look to where the problems are, what you can do. You can make additional reductions in Medicare payments, but you don't take it all out of Medicare because that shifts costs. You can adjust subsidies or change tax policy. You can.
What does that mean?
That means
you raise taxes?
It means that, well, we have the issue in the speech last night about the president talking about taxing high-cost plans.
What you're saying and what the president's saying is if the thing costs more than he thinks it's going to cost, taxes could go up.
Well, I think that the important, I'm not talking about new revenues, and I don't think either is he. You're talking about mechanisms to create greater efficiencies. And one of the arguments for, which I'm not totally a fan of.
Don't you think that people...
Oh, you didn't want me to finish?
No. I just want to stop you for a moment, and I don't mean to interrupt, but
that's okay.
Mechanisms that cause greater efficiencies, isn't that the kind of language that makes people squirm? Because what does it mean?
Well, then what it means is paying insurance companies, getting rid of some of the exorbitant profits. That's what we're doing. Excuse me, the administrative costs, which we're doing with the exchange. It means getting rid of unnecessary hospitalizations, huge savings there. It means reducing the time that doctors and nurses spend in paperwork and documentation. Patients know how wasteful the system is.
Joe Antos.
You know, the problem with this, I'm going to call this the trigger because it really is a trigger. The problem is that it doesn't have to be real. This was an appeal to the Congressional Budget Office. They're going to score a trigger. Generally, they're going to score a trigger like this as actually meeting the fiscal targets. Now, scoring isn't the issue. The issue is reality. When we get out there, will Congress actually pass tough legislation? Because Congress has to act again to cut spending in the various ways that Judy's talking about. Will Congress actually take those actions, and how quickly will those actions occur? We've been talking about this for decades. It hasn't happened yet.
Norm Ornstein, let me throw you a couple of things that people are saying across Twitter as we have our conversation going on here. Real-time results at DR Show, we call it. Here's what one person says. I think it changed some of the American public's mind. My conservative friend now favors his plan. Another one, I think he's thrown the progressives under the bus in order to play nice with Republicans who support profits over people. Another one, passion but little news, resembles the failing Massachusetts mandate plan. I prefer fiscally prudent H.R. 676. There's somebody who's watching it closely. Norman?
I wonder which member of Congress that was. I do think that you're going to find some on the left unhappy with this, because while we didn't get all the details, the president's plan actually bears some eerie resemblance, as he outlined it, to what Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, has been floating out there, which is a scaled-back version and one that, frankly, ought to have some considerable appeal for Republicans, although, as I said earlier, I think the zeitgeist on the one side of the aisle not to give him anything may make that more difficult. But you're going to get some distemper on the left. And That's just a reality of things. It did, I think, change some minds, although the audiences for these kinds of speeches are not so overwhelming. But I think more than changing minds to having people support reform, if he can just soften up the opposition, deal with that large number of people in the middle who, as soon as you get close to change, begin to think that the devil they know is better than the devil they don't, if he can leave them open and receptive to having something happen, then he's going to be in a much better position to make this work. And I think the odds are, because Democrats in Congress know the consequences of failure, know that if they lose, they're the ones who are going to suffer dramatically next November, that he's going to get something here.
Well, Barack Obama last night in the speech, the president tried to lay out some of the particulars of his plan. He said it'll be against the law for insurance companies to deny you coverage if you have pre-existing conditions, be against the law for companies to drop your coverage if you get sick, or water it down when you need it, his words. He said there would no longer be a cap on the amount of coverage you could be given and receive in a year or a lifetime, a limit on how much you can be charged for out-of-pocket expenses. And he said insurance companies would be required to cover, with no extra charge, routine checkups, preventive care. He cited as examples mammograms, colonoscopies, preventive care. Now, there's a question from a listener via email, Lane in Bloomfield, Michigan, who says, I'd really appreciate an explanation of the type of health care coverage that members of the Congress have, because knowing this might help us understand the attitudes of some in Congress. Who can give us a 20-second clip on Congress and what they've got? Carrie, Politico.
Well, Congress, what's most widely talked about is the fact that they have access to a whole bunch of different insurance options. They already have the option of an exchange, which is what the president is talking about, where private insurers compete for their business. They can choose amongst a different range of plans from, minimal coverage or lower coverage to very, very high coverage. And the idea is that they can choose. They have options, whereas, other Americans don't have options. So they have access to coverage. People in Iowa can buy. They have, federal workers in Iowa have a choice no matter what's going on in Iowa. So and the plans are very rich and affordable. So that's what Democrats, since the tail end of the Clinton effort to get reform, have said, we have this great insurance. You should have access to it, too.
All right. Let me go to the phones here and start bringing our listeners into the conversation. Al, you're calling from San Antonio, Texas, and thanks for joining us.
Yes. President Obama said that there is a tremendous amount of waste and inefficiency that exists, and that by improving that, he will generate tremendous amount of funds. If those things exist, why don't we do it now? Why don't we eliminate waste? Why don't we increase efficiency now and use that money to provide insurance for those that are now without?
Thanks, Al. Judy Fader, you want to take that?
I'm really glad you asked, because those are the details I wanted to give you. That's what essentially insurance companies are not, private insurers are not doing the job on their own, and the federal government's not been as aggressive as they need to be. What we need is to change the rules so that insurance companies can't make money by avoiding paying when they're sick, so that they've got to focus more on efficiency. And we need a really aggressive strategy for moving away for paying so much more than we need to private insurers, for high-tech, low-value services, and shift the system to rewarding primary care, prevention, managing chronic illness. That's a strategy that actually is in the House legislation, having the Medicare program take the lead. And actually, when we really push on Medicare and have a fail-safe to back it, we can expect action, because we've seen it in the past, the private sector following an innovative Medicare program.
All right, back to the phones. Mary from Rockville, Maryland. Hi, your question, please.
Yes. What did the president mean when the interruption took place? I believe the president was saying would not apply to those here illegally.
The health insurance coverage for illegal immigrants in this country. Who wants to take that on?
Well, he was saying that the bills that have been written say they will not cover illegal immigrants. And you saw him last night. He said there were 30 million.
But that has gotten out there into the echo chamber in some fashion is what he was trying to address his critics who
exactly.
say it will cover illegal immigrants. Correct?
Yes. He's saying it won't cover illegal immigrants.
Others have said that it will.
Others have said it will. And he made a shift last night in terms of how many people he's saying are uninsured. He said 30 million.
Yeah, suddenly that number came down.
It's usually been 47, 46 million. But right. The White House is making a shift here. They're trying to say there's about 10 million. Who are illegal immigrants. So they're no longer going to say 47 million. They're going to say there's American citizens, he said in his speech last night.
Joe, you're furrowing your brow here.
Yeah, I we're only guessing about how many illegals there are because they don't generally respond to government questionnaires. And I think the 10 number is a little high. I thought he was talking about the number of people who can't buy coverage. I believe that was the language, can't get coverage. And I think that was interpreted also as people who don't have the funds. I think 30 seems like a pretty small number. And given that we know from the House bill, from the CBO estimates, that that's about how many might be covered newly under the House bill, who's left over isn't just the illegals.
I'm Frank Sesno of Planet Forward and the George Washington University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Carrie.
Yeah, I was just going to add that part of their calculation also is that there are people who could be on Medicaid who just have chosen not to do it or don't do Medicaid, and that's a couple of million. So there is, in terms of them talking about 30 million, I think we're going to hear that more from
them. All right, a lot of what's been kicking around and a lot of what's been very controversial is the so-called public option. Now, what the president said last night, he said the public insurance option would have to be self-sufficient. It would have to rely on premiums that it collects itself. He said could be done by avoiding overhead, but he said it could be a good deal for consumers. Now, Norm Ornstein, he made a very interesting comparison. He said that the public option could serve the same sort of role as public colleges and universities play in higher education. They could provide additional choice and competition, but without getting in the way of the system of private colleges and universities. Is that an accurate comparison?
You know, I had wondered in the past why that had not been invoked more often, because, of course, the opposition to the public plan from many is a fear that it is, to use the cliche, the camel's nose under the tent. It's an attempt to move us towards a single-payer system by having a government plan that is subsidized enough that it becomes cheaper than anything else, and more people flock to it, and eventually everything else atrophies. But, of course, the fact is we've had public colleges and universities that have not, even though they're much cheaper, have not than private universities, killed the private college system. Having said that, Frank, I think the reality here, as it has been for a long time, is the votes are simply not there in Congress to get a public plan, even the kind that the president is talking about. And in the end, despite his robust defense of a public plan and support for it, which will make some of the liberal Democrats in Congress happy, the bigger signal that he was sending there was this is not the be-all and end-all here. And while we may very well end up with subsidies for nonprofit co-ops and a trigger, as they say, that if the private insurance industry does not step up to the plate and cover people the way they've pledged to do and the way they're supposed to, then in 5 years the guillotine will come down and we'll get a really robust public plan. The odds are slim to none that we'll get the kind of public plan the president was talking about in his speech last night.
Back to the phones. James, you're calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And James, if my note here is correct, I see that you're a high school student. Is that right?
Yes, I'm a high school student at Bishop Kelly High School.
Well, we welcome your question from a different perspective and a different demographic, as we say. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, if when I get turned 65 years old, if we don't do the reform, how much money am I going to be able to get out of Social Security?
Social Security or Medicare? You're talking about the or both?
Both.
Okay. Judy Fetter?
It's a really important question, and what you're saying is recognizing is that we've got to get control of health care costs in order to make Medicare affordable well into the future and to protect you. And that's exactly why we're talking about slowing cost growth in these health reforms. So we're committed, I want you to know, that to making sure that health care is there for you when you turn 65. And thanks for caring.
Joe.
Well, I don't know about the commitment, but I certainly agree with Judy that we need to get costs, healthcare costs under control, not just federal costs, which is what Judy and the caller are talking about, but overall costs. And my advice to the young man is get a good job and save. Save and invest. That's the solution, not Social Security.
I hear Norm. I hear you chuckling at the other end of the line there, Norm.
Well, certainly, nobody should rely on Social Security alone if they have the resources to put into other pension plans.
But the question he's asking is a very important one, and that is, are the steps going to be taken now to assure the fiscal sanity and security of this country into his future? And that is as much as providing for people now what this moment should be about. We're asking people to absorb and understand an awful lot, though, because there's so much projected out there that we don't know about. Well, coming up, we will continue our conversation on the president's speech last night and the prospect for health care in this day, your calls and questions on The Diane Rehm Show. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sex trafficking, acid attacks, and mass rape. Two Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists on why the battle against widespread abuse of women in poor countries is the moral challenge of this century and key to addressing the root causes of many of the world's most pressing problems. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about President Barack Obama's speech, the particulars of it, the politics surrounding it. If you missed it last night or haven't caught up, among the details, he said if you lose a job or change a job, you'll still be able to get health care coverage under his plan. If you start a small business, you'll be able to get coverage. And he says one way you do this is by creating this new insurance exchange. Another point he made was individuals will be required to carry basic health insurance just as they are required to buy auto insurance if they have a car. Barack Obama also laid down the gauntlet to those on the Hill.
Now, this is the plan I'm proposing. It's a plan that incorporates ideas from many of the people in this room tonight, Democrats and Republicans. And I will continue to seek common ground in the weeks ahead. If you come to me with a serious set of proposals, I will be there to listen. My door is always open. But know this, I will not waste time with those who have made the calculation that it's better politics to kill this plan than to improve it. I won't stand by while the special interests use the same old tactics to keep things exactly the way they are. If you misrepresent what's in this plan, we will call you out. And I will not accept the status quo as a solution. Not this time. Not now.
And an email from John in the state of Maine, Carrie, from Politico. My senators, Ms. Snow and Ms. Collins, John writes, are thoughtful members of the GOP. We're proud of them. Up here in Yankee land, we're horrified at what we witnessed this summer. Now, Senators Snow and Collins are going to be very important in the way this bill proceeds.
Absolutely. They are the two Republicans that most people think are possible Republican votes. And Senator Snow, she has been the most positive about the plan that Senator Max Baucus put out over the weekend. She also put out a pretty positive statement last night in response to the president's.
So John from Maine, his question is, are there other traditional GOPers, he writes, who will join them, or are they alone in the Senate?
You know, it's possible. I mean, I reported over the weekend that there's this look at some of the retiring Republican senators, Kit Bond and George Voinovich. Of course, they seem like long shots, but people have their eye on them because they won't have to face repercussions if they vote for a bill that the rest of the Republican caucus does not. You know, if you significantly scale it down, you might get more Republicans. But there is a very small pool of possible Republican senators, and Snow and Collins are at the top of the list.
Let's go to Long Island now, and Jerry, who's on the line with a question. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much. I have not yet heard it mentioned, and I can't for the life of me understand why. We up here in Long Island, we've got a rather litigious medical environment. It's pretty notorious up here. One of the things that I see as a tremendous benefit for a universal health plan, and particularly a public option, is that the reason most people sue, I mean, let's be realistic. If you're damaged by someone, you need to sue for your health care coverage for the rest of your life, your benefits, whatever it is you need to treat those damages. It adds up for the rest of your life, which is why the rewards are so huge. If we have a universal health care plan that covers everyone, those damages are now going to fall away from the equation. When these
What do you mean those damages are going to fall? You mean if there's tort reform, if those suits don't proceed? Is that what you're asking?
Well, no. What I'm saying is if you're covered, if you know you're going to have health care, if you're sure of it, you don't need to sue for these damages.
Okay. All right. Let's bounce that around. But, Judy, the one reason people sue is if they're hurt and they have less ability to earn money. In many cases, it's to replace earnings.
Right. I think the caller has a point, though, about the medical expenses, and that's a piece of it. But the suits do go well beyond that. It's the ability to earn. It's punitive damages when there's been negligence. I think there are a number of reasons. But what you're saying, caller, is that that they will have coverage, and that is true. I think the other, a very important element of reform to improve the system overall is to get better quality care. That is a big piece or a big goal of getting better information to docs to know what the right treatment is and to hold them accountable for doing it.
So if to follow on the caller's point, then if you're assured of coverage going forward, you don't have a lifetime cap in the case that something catastrophic happens, how much would that actually affect the cost of health care? Has that been calculated out?
Well,
the need for these lawsuits?
Yeah, well, the lawsuits, I think that come from for a lot of reasons, as we said. But the importance of having the care is what health reform is all about.
Deborah from Plymouth, Michigan is on the line. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I'm concerned as a private citizen purchasing insurance on my own. I'm not through a company or anything like that. I have to go out and purchase it on my own. And for my family, which is, you know, a family of three, I'm paying almost $1,000 a month in premiums.
$1,000 a month in premiums?
$1,000 a month I pay to the Blue Cross Blue Shield here in Michigan. And I just got a letter from them this week telling me that next month, effective October 1st, my premium is going up by 33.14%, which is an increase of about $330 per month.
Your insurance, wait a minute. So your insurance is going to go up over $300 a month. Was there an explanation offered in there?
Yes. They are saying because they are being forced to cover people with pre-existing conditions that they are going to have to make up the cost through increased premiums. And we are sorry. Well, I may lose my insurance now because I can't afford those kind of premiums. I mean, I've never had anything go up by 33% in one fell swoop. I'm a business owner myself, and I could never impose those kind of increases on my customers.
So what is your so what would your question be then in the context of this larger healthcare debate we're having?
Well, my question is, how is this plan by forcing, you know, us to pay for all of these people with pre-existing conditions and people without health care, we're going to lose a lot of people, such as myself. We're going to fall into the bucket of people with no insurance because we can't afford to absorb the extra cost.
Okay, Deborah, thanks very much. Joe Antos, why don't you start us off on this?
Well, I think the general idea that the Obama administration has is that if you cover effectively everybody, then you've spread those additional costs of people with these pre-existing conditions over a much larger population. That's the insurance principle. That's pooling, and that is correct if you can do it. What is often missed in that argument is something that the caller is referring to. And that is that the average premium then has to go up. Now, not by 33%.
But in what you're saying and what the Obama administration is proposing, would Deborah's premiums then come back down again, or would they stay where they are, go up even more?
Well, that's a hard thing to predict.
I mean, she's being told now that her premiums are jumping to cover the uninsured.
Right. What I would argue is that instead of seeing a 33% increase because of this, under the Obama plan, she would see a substantially smaller increase, but everybody's going to see a smaller increase off of a larger base of premiums.
Judy Fetter, you're shaking your head no.
Yeah, I agreed with Joe where he started in terms of the need to bring everybody in so that you have not just people coming in when they're sick, but so that everybody's covered all the time and we spread risks, have healthy people paying for us when we're sick. And I'm not sure that you got the right explanation for why your premium got hiked, but what's really different will be really different for this small businesswoman is that she will be part of a broader insurance pool, and it will not just be a function of her situation in a narrow marketplace. It will be a broader marketplace, which creates the potential for much greater stability in insurance premiums at the same time we work to slow cost growth.
Norman Ornstein, on a very practical level, isn't it true that virtually everyone out there is going to look at their own personal circumstance, in this case we heard from Deborah, and ask themselves, what does the Obama plan do for me? And yet, getting those answers is very difficult.
It is, and it's always been one of the great obstacles to getting change. The universal public definition of health care reform is, as it has always been, reform is where I pay less. It's hard to make that case. And even though there's, I believe, widespread dissatisfaction with the system, for people who are insured, every year, the normal dynamic is that your employer comes to you and says, you know, we're going to have to change the plan. It's just gotten too expensive. Higher copays, higher out-of-pocket expenses, maybe not the same doctors. You can't get particular drugs. So change can be good in a lot of ways, but the closer you get to it, the more people who, having insurance and not having catastrophic illnesses means that they feel at least reassured and covered, are going to grow uneasy that maybe government is going to make it harder for them or that they'll pay more so that others can pay less. And overcoming that unease is critical to building some level of public support. And that's where I think much that was in the president's speech last night will work to his advantage.
Next caller is Jordan from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Jordan.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, my question was, I was listening, and obviously they were talking, President Obama was talking about how this wasn't going to add any more debt to do this plan. And the question was, is obviously the GOP came back with a response immediately after and was talking, kind of contradicting everything that he was saying around that, saying he was going to add more to our national debt. And as moderate, and, you know, I'm a Republican sometimes, and I agree with Democrats, others, who do you believe in this situation? I mean, it's kind of tough to when everyone's contradicting each other all the time.
Okay, Carrie Budoff-Brown, you work for Politico. Who should we believe?
Well, in the first 10 years, the president is presenting a plan that, that would be deficit neutral and that the first 10 years it would not add to the deficit. I think there's a lot of conflicting research and opinions on what happens after the 10 years. The president's also proposing a lot of reforms that would that are meant to take hold after the first 10-year budget window. That would keep costs down. But there's a lot of this concern stems from what the effect of the public option would be on the federal budget over the course of time. I'm sometimes where your caller is in that, you know, there's so much conflicting information and there's a lot of unknown quantities and how this will all play out, which is why there are people talking about a trigger to get more savings if they don't materialize.
Joe Antos, who do we believe?
Well, I don't know who you believe, but we...
Who's
we,
right?
That's a good question, too. We'll find out over the course of the next 20 years or so. However, one political fact, and this is true for, I think, all major legislation that involves huge expenditures, and that is that the real spending doesn't start for a few years. That the reforms, and in this case, it's perfectly reasonable. You need a few years, 4 or 5 years, to actually get all the little pieces to come together. But so when you look at the cost estimates, and when you see this claim that it's only going to cost $900 billion only over the next 10 years, keep in mind that we're only talking about a plan that comes into effect 5 years from now. So further out, there's a bigger cost challenge, and the question is, can the great ideas that people talk about, will they really materialize?
Judy?
Well, I'll tell you can believe, because it's true, there's lots of uncertainty, but it's consistent with all the calls we've heard, that if we don't do this, we're going to see those premium hikes of $300 on a $1,000 bill a month. The high schooler who's worried about Medicare and Social Security, but Medicare particularly here in the future, is right to be worried that we won't be able to afford it. We're going to see continued cutbacks. What we're saying is that we need to put in place, and that's what President Obama did, the measures that make it affordable in the future.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation in the minutes remaining, call us at 1-800-433-8850. Or you could still send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. And I want to go to the calls now, and we have Mike from Rocky Mount, Virginia on the line. Hi, Mike.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Quickly. It's real simple. I have an insurance plan, and companies are watering them down that we have. I used to pay a $500 deductible, and now I pay the first $6,000 on my insurance plan. They offered another plan which they had no prescription at all, and you'd pay $4,000 on it. I think we need a public auction because everybody's looking at profits. I'm wondering how much profits this insurance company actually makes off of everybody.
Okay, Mike. Thanks very much. How much profits? How much out of pocket? Are these questions being answered yet?
Well, we know is that the private insurers, in order to keep those premiums down, are cutting benefits, and that what we need is real cost containment and good benefits.
But how does the president's plan address what we just heard?
What it does, what it will guarantee this caller, is a full-fledged benefit plan that he can afford. When the caller mentions also the public plan, the role of a public plan, the goal is to stop having insurers make profits by cutting off care and denying care, and instead by creating real competition. That's the goal of the public plan.
Norm Ornstein, I want to come back to you. We just have a couple of minutes remaining, everybody. So let's kind of try to wrap this up and figure out what the roadmap is ahead. What do you expect to see happen now? The president's gone to the Congress. He's gone to the country. He's made his case. What do you expect will happen?
Well, two things are going to happen now. The first is we're now looking to the Senate, where Max Baucus has said that he is going to begin to wrap up his committee's conclusions. It's the one major committee left unheard from here, starting next week, starting on the 21st with a markup of a bill. We're going to wait to see if some of the Republicans, the gang of six, the three Republican senators, Mike Enzi of Wyoming, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, and Olympia Snowe of Maine, respond in any positive way to the Baucus plan, which is a kind of a compromise version with many of the elements that the president was talking about. The second is we're going to be looking at the House, where you have a number of committees who've issued bills, and they're going to start a process to meld them together into something that can get 218 votes on the floor of the House. And one critical question there is what kind of public plan and what will be the reaction of the president's liberal base to what emerges from the House. And there will be looking as much as anything to the combination of Henry Waxman and Nancy Pelosi. So over the next 3 weeks or so, I think we're going to start to see some of the legislative process crystallize a bit more and give us a sense of where we're going.
Okay, Carrie Budoff-Brown, you get the last word. You expect to see something big get passed?
That's anybody's guess. I don't think anybody would put money on a definitive yes or no at this point, but we're going to see.
So as we say in the business, stay tuned. To our guests today, Judy Fader, Joseph Antos, and Carrie Brown Budoff, along with Norman Ornstein, thanks for a great conversation. I'm Frank Sesno. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.